In evaluating the future, I've often thought that if we look back to the past, that it helps provide a glimpse into the future. And when I went through some training with my corporation, I found out that that was a special, I don't know if you call it talent, maybe a proclivity of my life out of five dominant characteristics. Looking to the past was one of the things that helps me gauge the future. This would be in personal things, in terms of how do we react to circumstances. So maybe it's just the way I'm built, so to speak, as a personality, that in order to make sense of what's happening now, I often look backwards. And that's just part of a characteristic of 34 major characteristics that can be evaluated, but I have top five. Everybody's got their top five. But at any rate, that's where I feel comfortable, I guess. So I just have that natural bent anyway. And from a biblical perspective, that kind of makes sense because the past is sometimes a prologue to the future. Gives us a glimpse into what is going to happen in terms of what is ahead. We know that there is the illustration of Moses, Elijah, and John the Baptist, and then the two witnesses. They all have this synergy between them, and they all have certain attributes and abilities that point to the future of the two witnesses. Patterns sometimes repeat. And so that was the premise that I began with in a preparation of today's sermon, that maybe the past might be a prologue to the future, and I decided to investigate and research an area that I've never heard explained or even talked about in the church or in a sermon. It's a specific area of the future, and I found out why it's probably never been explored. It's because there's not a whole lot of information there that helps us to understand the future. But I was undaunted, and I went ahead and prepared the sermon anyway, knowing all of that. I wanted to find something in the past that would help us to understand an important personality in the Bible, and I touched on that personality last week. He's identified in one specific area of prophecy, and he's called the man of sin, or the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians, but we won't go there now. I thought, if we could isolate those responsible, if we could examine the lives of those who were responsible for the coronation of emperors in the Holy Roman Empire, and maybe it would give us a glimpse into the tendencies of that particular individual, the man of sin. Many of you have this. Okay, in unison, this is called the... Okay, do I need to put this up on a PowerPoint? All right, are you ready? Everybody see this? Let me say that it is got a lot of lines, and it's been in many booklets through the years. Are you afraid to be wrong? This is called the Beast Chart. Thank you. Oh boy. All right. After services today, there will be a Bible study on this chart. How embarrassing this is going to be when it's put up on the internet and we don't get a response and everybody's thinking, what is the matter with that congregation in Tucson? Okay, maybe this chart is not in our current booklets. How many times have I given this chart out? A dozen times through the years? Failure. I'm leaving. I'm quitting. I'm throwing down my papers in disgust and out of here. I thought you might know what this is. Perhaps you're just too scared to render an opinion out loud. Okay, seriously. If we could isolate and examine the lives of those who were responsible, who are on this side of the page, emperors of the Holy Roman Empire, then maybe it'd give us a glimpse into this futuristic man of sin. So, I was a little bit disappointed with the research, but again, I'm going to plow on and give you the results. No, seriously, there is a point to all of this above and beyond. If we could identify, we can easily identify the heads of state of the Holy Roman Empire. And since you may or may not have this handy, you can find that it shows the resurrections of a Roman Empire. And you'll find on this list the names Justinian, Charlemagne, Otto the Great, Charles V or Charles the Great, and Napoleon. Five different resurrections of what is called the Holy Roman Empire. And each of these emperors claim themselves as the inheritors of that kingdom throughout history. Now, that is provable. That is a fact. What you don't find so much information are these glorious pontiffs, these religious leaders who, in their might and their power and their so-called divinity, help these individuals to the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. The chart identifies also afterwards the unification of Italian states beginning in the 1870s with Garibaldi and all the way up to Mussolini and World War II. And he had an agreement with Hitler. Those were the Axis powers along with Japan, for those of you that know your history of World War II. The title of the sermon is dramatic in order to get bites on the internet. The man of sin unveiled at last. I added that at last with an exclamation point. That's the title. But in case you didn't realize, the Holy Roman Empire, as you examine it through history, wasn't holy at all. It wasn't sanctified by God. It was sanctified by men. Those who led the Holy Roman Empire were not beneficent. They were not great and glorious leaders who served mankind. They were despots. They were authoritarian dictators. They had very little regard for human life. Now, this is in contrast with the romanticism of the past. And looking back and what Europe has done in the past is look back to the grandeur and the order of the Roman Empire as something that was so great and so wonderful and caused prosperity for so many. And yet it was not really romantic at all, unless you were sitting on top of the throne, maybe. It was filled with death, destruction, misery for the masses, religious pogroms, the persecution of true Christians and Jews. And Margaret Thatcher accurately said that Europe has only been united in anarchy. Anarchy. And often it's anarchy that brings about and has brought about the unification of Europe. Now, that hasn't deterred Europe from trying to unify. And going back all the way to the time of, well, my early childhood, and even right after World War II in the early 50s, there was this desire. Europe realized that it should come together. And in order to prevent the kind of wars that the 20th century had brought about, World War I, devastating loss of life, and then World War II, which was brought about by the reparations that the Germans had to pay in World War I, as explained last week, there has been this desire to get together, to create Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, and what has been romantically thought of as the golden age of Europe. They want to reclaim a common heritage, and yet that common heritage is filled with bloodshed and persecution. The union of church and state and Europe, the unions of the church and the state in Europe, fill the pages of history with blood and violence and religious inquisition and intolerance. And yet, that's what many people want. I remember speaking with Mr. LaRavia on several occasions of his meeting the descendant of the Habsburg dynasty, which was a part of this Holy Roman Empire. And this was a good man. He came to Ambassador College back in the 80s. Mr. LaRavia entertained him, and he was highly educated, and he was the heir apparent to a throne that he was never able to ascend to, but he was in that lineage of the Charles V of the Habsburg dynasty. You know, you read, okay, just a little exercise. If you want to do this, look up Otto von Habsburg. And this is a man that went into exile prior to World War II. And just take a look at the number of titles that he was given. I mean, Archduke of this and that, and Holy Roman Empire and this and that. I mean, probably a dozen different empires is what he supposedly was to inherit. And highly educated, probably fluent in five or six languages, and a nice, gentle guy, according to none other than our own Mr. LaRavia. But the rest of European history is not really filled with beneficence or with searching or helping mankind to really find a way. The idea of a united Europe that is aligned powerfully together, economically, politically, and militarily, and religiously, is a dream that some Europeans still have today. It hasn't been realized through peaceful means. It hasn't come about with political integration because there are still different states, right? It hasn't come about with economic interests. They have a currency. It hasn't ever been what they thought it might be, or even what maybe a lot of us in the church thought it might be, kind of on par with the dollar. It's not the most powerful currency in the world. It's still one of the most powerful. It's made some headway. But since the idea of a unified Europe in the 50s was hatched by the framers of the European Union, it has really never been achieved in the same way. There is no integration militarily. There is no true integration, except maybe some dropping of borders here and there. They've lost the United Kingdom. At Brexit 5 years ago, with success, the people of England decided, hey, we're done with this. We're done with bureaucrats in Brussels telling us what to do and organizing our lives. That independent spirit was alive for a little bit. Now, as we see current events happening within the United Kingdom, maybe not so much of that independent spirit. A lot has happened in the last 5 years. No one seems to be championing the idea of a unified Europe now. And yet, most of us recognize that it's something on the horizon that will happen. Now, this is in contrast to many years ago, even 40 years ago, upwards of 40 years ago, in 1983, there was Pope John Paul II, and I was struck by something that someone said at that time, that when examining his life and his attitude, it is apparent that there is no way that this man could occupy the office that we see in Bible prophecy. And I thought, really? Wow. And it was a very astute statement, because here was, by all accounts, somebody that wanted to do something good. A highly educated pope from Poland who wanted to bring about a unification of Europe and make it better than it was, and to create a religious renaissance among Europeans. And he asked for Europe to rediscover its roots. Again, it was a romanticized idea of the roots in which Europe would be politically, militarily, economically, but most of all, religiously unified. But when you examine the history, that history is filled again with bloodshed and tyranny, and not this loving, great, religious, romanticized attitude that Pope John Paul II had. Maybe just his thought process, maybe what he wanted was to make it better. But he said, "I, John Paul, a son of the Polish nation that has always considered itself European by its origins, traditions, culture, and vital relations, Slav among Latins and Latin among the Slavs, I, Bishop of Rome and pastor of the Universal Church from Santiago," he was in Spain at the time, "issue to you, old Europe, a cry full of love. Find yourself, be yourself, discover your origins, give life to your roots." And wow, when we heard those words back in the 80s, we thought at the time, maybe something significant could be brewing on the horizon. We thought that that church leader issuing a call to action might instigate a change in Europe, because he had, without a doubt, the greatest popularity and presence of any pope in the history of the Roman Church. And after that time, this whole idea kind of fizzled out, kind of went away. After the Berlin Wall fell, then there wasn't as much enthusiasm, and I don't know why. I mean, it just wasn't the time, I guess. There wasn't much enthusiasm or worry, because once the state of Germany became reunited again, there didn't seem to be kind of the religious zeal to get that accomplished. You see what I mean? Because Eastern Germany was communist. Some people there undoubtedly clung to their faith. And there was this religious cry, along with political, military, economic cry, for Germany to be reunited again, because it had been split up. Russians had taken control of East Berlin at World War II. If Patton had had his way, that would have never happened, but Patton didn't have his way. He judged them for doing what they eventually did. But then Germany became reunited in 1989, and there was seemingly a loss of this religiosity or this desire. And so it continues today. And so if you were to look at Europe today, you would say, this is a mess. There's no religious fervor. There's no desire to get together. And still no united power, politically speaking. European supremacy has been on the back burner for decades. Because the British Commonwealth and the United States have still dominated, but we don't know how long that's going to continue. Turn to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13 and verse 3. Let me preface this by saying that for you to be a member of the Church of God, to be converted, to have the gift of God's Holy Spirit, does not require that you become an expert in history or, quite honestly, in prophecy. Now, do I think that it's helpful to be aware? I sure do. I believe that it's pretty important. But prophecy can be a very complex thing in terms of understanding the Bible. And what we have always tried to do as a church organization, I don't say that we're 100% perfect in this, we have always tried to allow the Bible to interpret itself. And when evaluating the Bible and ancient history, we try to remain true to the historical facts and allow the historical facts to guide our understanding of what has already occurred. This chapter talks about things that have already occurred, and you can either prove it for yourself or deny it. I mean, you know, in one sense, it doesn't really matter to me. I mean, each individual has to make his own decision on these things. I was convinced on the basis of it when I first came to the Church of God, and I found that the Church of God taught and understood things that nobody else did. So that's for the individual to evaluate. I believe John was put there on the Isle of Patmos, and he gazed out onto the sea, into the Mediterranean Sea, and God presented him with this particular vision in chapter 13 of things that had happened in the past, and whether John understood perfectly that they had. We coordinate them with things that had happened hundreds and hundreds of years earlier, and basically the same vision was given to Daniel. And we kind of coordinate these chapters of Revelation 13 and Daniel 7. And we understand that from the works of Herodotus and other ancient historians, that they have correctly identified some of the things that Daniel saw in vision. So, not that we're going to go into Daniel in an extra way today, we may not, but it's interesting that they talk about basically a same beast. Now, beast is king or kingdom, and that's fundamental to the understanding here, and we know that from Daniel 7. But John is looking out, and he sees something arise out of the ocean, this huge beast. And he says in verse 1, I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads, 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, just like in Daniel 7. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Now, through history, when we see these relatively dynamic resurrections of this particular beast, I would say that the aspect of satanic intervention is much less than what it will be at the time of the end. Not to say that that influence hasn't been a part of these resurrections of HRE, as we call it, or as I would call it. And I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. Just a very simple sentence. There was a fall of the Roman Empire, 476 AD. All that glory, that grandeur, that wonder, that organization, the beautiful roads, the aqueducts, the organization of the military and the economic system and everything else, the stamping of coins and the universal law throughout the kingdom that was in place during the time of Christ. All of that which they thought was beautiful came crashing to an end, because Germanic tribes came down and they invaded Rome and they pillaged and they burned and everything else that foreign armies do in their occupation. And Rome was down and out for the count, lying on the mat, done, over, fini. Rome was dead. And along with it, all of that history. I've got an 8-volume set in my library, Gibbon's Rome. Gibbon was a historian from Britain, And he detailed all of this wonder that was Rome for 500 years, going back even 1,000 years before it fell. Rome was magnificent, had these wonderful buildings, and they went over much of the known world. They went up into Gaul, which is France, and Britain, and they were ruling everywhere. You can't do that without having something going for you. And so there has always been this romanticized vision of the beauty, the grandeur, the wonder of Rome. Even though when you study Roman history and you study the emperors of Rome, you see that there's the Roman Senate, you know, there's the plays that Shakespeare has written about Rome, you see the intrigue of the palace and everything. So it wasn't all wonderful. There's a lot of human nature, but that all seems to get lost when people get in their heads this vision of how great Rome was, how wonderful it was. You know, they usually don't look to the thousands upon thousands of people that lose their lives in these titanic battles with swords and spears and people getting slashed to death. That's not so glorious, I guess, unless you're the warrior that comes home victorious. Rome was mortally wounded. It fell. And that's what's described here, briefly, the chart. But it was reunified in 554 AD by an individual that became an emperor by the name of Justinian. Now, he came from Constantinople and he came to Rome and he got together with the Roman Pope at that particular time. And that Roman Pope accepted him as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And he was a pope that you've probably never heard of, and I'm going to have to look ahead in my notes to find his name, which was Vigilius. Somebody that most of us, and frankly, I had not really ever heard of him until this time. And he was the pope at that time, but there was no grand ceremony where the Vigilius takes a crown and puts it on the head of Justinian. He just accepted that Justinian came in and he was going to defend Rome from these barbaric tribes. And so he was content with that. And that's basically all you need to know about Justinian. Except, for a while, the foreign tribes that had occupied Rome were subdued. But there's very little to note of the Pope that was present at that particular time. But as I mentioned, all these resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire have had this fascination. When Justinian came in, all of Rome was happy. And the Pope at that time was so happy because now, maybe because they had written records, they had their language, they had Latin, they had libraries, they knew how great Rome had been. Maybe we can reclaim all of that. Since the time of Justinian, this is something that you may not necessarily be aware of. Since the time of Justinian, all leaders of what are mentioned as part of the Roman Empire on this side, all of them have been German, of Germanic origin. If you're talking about Justinian, Charlemagne, Otto the Great, Charles V, Napoleon even, and then up to the next one, which is Garibaldi and then Mussolini, and they had a German head of the Axis powers with Hitler. They have all been German. Even Napoleon was of a Germanic tribe. His family came from the same area as Justinian the Great. An Illyrian tribe of northern Italy, which was a Germanic region at the time. So it's kind of an interesting story. And it would be the speculation, at least of me, that the future leader of a revived Roman Empire would have a German head. Just a thought. And that if everything holds, then that last religious leader would also be Roman or Italian. Because all of them have been since that time. All of them with these revived Roman empires, they have all been Italian. It's just kind of interesting. So just to give you a clue as to all of these, quote, glorious Roman commanders, beginning with Justinian. Justinian's motto was one empire, one church, one law. So far, so good. One ancient historian wrote, killing, in the opinion of Justinian, was hardly to be ranked as murder if those who died did not share his beliefs. Okay, it's okay to kill somebody and thousands of people as long as they don't share your beliefs. Justinian took the persecution of heretics. What's a heretic in this definition? Anybody that doesn't agree with Justinian. Justinian took the persecution of heretics to a historically unprecedented level. This is after 554 AD. Under Constantine, who was the emperor many years earlier, people were exiled, some were killed. Yeah, no big deal, just a few. Under Justinian, they were killed by the thousands. In his work, A History of Christianity, the British author Paul Johnson wrote, the process of integration of church and state, begun by Constantine, continued with until the two became inseparable. That's what we look for in the future. The Byzantine Empire became, in effect, a form of theocracy, with the emperor performing priestly and semi-divine functions and the Orthodox Church constituting a department of state in charge of spiritual affairs. This Vigilius, the Pope at that time, probably the thing he's most notable for was his agreement with the wife of Justinian that there was only one nature of Jesus Christ, and that was divine. Kind of goes back to what we were talking about last week. Now, eventually that idea died off even in that type of Christianity, and they accepted the fact that there were two natures, that Jesus was both fully human and fully man. But this is a idea that Theodora, who is the wife of Justinian, she embraced, so she convinced this pope to embrace, and then they faded off into the annals of history, and they were over with, and that pope was gone. The next emperor was Charlemagne, and he was actually the first pope to be consecrated, or he was the first pope to consecrate an emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, because he actually put a crown on the head of Charlemagne, who's the next one on the chart, the next of the resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. In 800 AD, on Christmas Eve, nonetheless, while Charlemagne was kneeling in a church in Aachen, Germany, praying, the Pope took a crown and placed it on his head. Why did he do that? Because he recognized him as a great leader and a wonderful person. Basically, because he was going to protect Rome. So that was Pope Leo III, and you can read about him as I did in the New World Encyclopedia. Leo pioneered what became the king-making role of popes. Because of his legacy, Europe remained a more unified, peaceful society with a greater sense of co-responsibility and of a common Christian identity that transcended national borders. This had implications, for example, in the legal sphere. Some ecclesiastical law was the same across Europe, even if civil law differed. The church's near monopoly on education, too, meant that it trained the scholars and the lawyers who tended to share the single society view of the Christian world. Some of that even extends even to the modern day. And for some of those of us who went, like Mr. Walden and I, went to college in Britain, we realized in getting to know people from the continent who came to the church and came to college that the church was still very influential even in the public schooling, not to mention the private schooling, which was basically done by the church. Pope Leo sent the keys of Rome to Charlemagne, indicating that he recognized the Frankish king with whom Adrian, the First enjoyed a close relationship as Rome's protector. So it was done to protect Rome and to accentuate Rome once again. Charlemagne felt that with his coronation, he had prevented the world from coming to an end, because he believed, Charlemagne did, in four ruling empires, just like most of us did from the book of Daniel. He believed that. He believed that his coronation was able to stop the end of the world. People have always thought the world is coming to an end, right? So anyway, given all of this, it was normal for Charlemagne to adopt Roman culture, its architecture, law, literature, keeping it alive, and that's what they did. That was how they honored the tradition of the past. And now we come to Pope John the 12th. I don't really even care if any of you even remember this. I'm going to forget it after this sermon, all these guys, because their main goal was political expediency. Their main goal was protecting themselves. But this pope was probably of all of the four who had a part in crowning or being a part of the coronation ceremony of a emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, he was probably the most immoral of all of them. He was a jerk. Of course, they had celibacy as a part. You couldn't marry if you were a Catholic priest, or especially the Pope, but many of them were undaunted in this way, shall we say. It didn't really stop them. But he actually recruited Otto the Great to come to the church's aid, to come to Rome's aid, and crowned him the Holy Roman Emperor in exchange for protection of Rome. Moving on, Charles the Great, the Fifth, was crowned by Pope Leo the Tenth, and he was the pope at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. Martin Luther was so aghast at what he found among the papacy when he visited Rome in the early 1500s, and the debauchery among the people that he thought were the leaders of the church at that time, and everything that he saw convinced him that that church had lost its way, and the result is the Lutheran Church. That's why he went back to Germany and nailed on the church door his 99 demands, whatever, because he was right that they were so bad. And this particular pope was certainly one of the worst. Now, Pope Pius the Seventh was the pope, and he was present at the coronation of Napoleon, the last of this association. Four really distinct popes, four of them from the time of Charlemagne all the way up to the time of Napoleon, who were actually present and actually participated in a coronation ceremony. Now, actually, the coronation of the kings of England probably had more grandeur and spectacle and pomp and circumstance than this, but this is what we're ended up with, and this is the history which has been romanticized and made so great, and which people will claim again and look back to. Some accounts say that Napoleon just took the crown and put it on his own head, and other accounts say that, and that's what we've written in the past. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there in 1804 or whenever. It wasn't something that any of us witnessed. Some people say the Pope just handed him the crown. There. Didn't put it on his head. Napoleon put it on his own head. So much for all the pomp, the circumstance, the majesty, and the beauty, the wonder of Rome. Now, there were four popes who presided during the early part of the 20th century, from St. Pius X to Pius XII. And in case you hadn't realized it, up until then, anybody that named Pius was probably not so pious. My research indicates a lot of weirdness, a lot of strangeness, a lot of debauchery, a lot of immorality among even those who are called the leaders of the church. I'm on a scale which is not really polite to speak about in mixed company. But In 1909, this was an interesting thing that happened. I just threw it in because I thought, yeah, sometimes people like some of the interesting things that have happened and some of the things. Not saying that it's going to happen, not saying that it's going to be true, but it's just nonetheless interesting that St. Pius X in 1909 was holding court, was in a company and giving a speech, and all of a sudden he fell into a trance. Yeah, he just like checked out for a while verbally, and he went into a trance, and the audience was watching, waiting, what's going to happen? And when he woke up, he cried out, "What I see is terrifying. Will it be me? Will it be my successor? What is certain is that the Pope will quit Rome, and in leaving the Vatican, he will have to walk over the dead bodies of the priests. Don't tell anybody this while I'm still alive." Well, I'm sure that some in the audience let it out. Just prior to his death in 1914, he had another vision. He says, "I have seen one of my successors of the same name," his real name was Joseph, "who is fleeing over the bodies of his brethren. He will take refuge in some hiding place, but after a brief respite, he will die a cruel death." Now, if he had a vision of what's going to happen when Jesus returns, then it was very vivid and very accurate, but we don't know. It's just an interesting thing, and I lay nothing to it except for that. Maybe it was a vision a demon gave him. I don't know, but it happened. The only thing that these popes, through the reincarnation of the Holy Roman Empires, had in common was that they're Italian, and that their alliance, in most cases, with the emperors that they crowned or were a part of crowning or a part of the whole unification of church and state, was that it was politically expedient, it was for the protection of Rome, it was kind of to get Rome back up on its feet. I've given you the names in case you want to do a deep dive, but to be honest with you, there's not much to really dive into historically speaking. And I guess if I were the curator of church history, I really wouldn't want any more to be developed about all of these characters either. But be that as it may, there still is this idea that there was scholarship, there was study into the Bible because the church had the Bible. Now, the historical records could be flawed, I'll admit, but overall, through a number of sources, they don't paint a pretty picture for this empire and this church-state grouping. From the time of Justinian to Napoleon, those who were in the offices of the church have been responsible for the persecution of all who didn't agree with them. And that was what is called the romantic heyday of the Holy Roman Empire. And believe it or not, it is going to be that which is looked to in the future as we've got to reclaim that. Who would want it? Who would want that? The debauchery, the evil, the persecution, the bloodshed, the war, the famine, the heartache. Yet it's going to be thought of as something we got to get back to. Yeah. Okay. Daniel chapter 7, verse 25. I am being a little silly to exaggerate to get the point across, because this is not going to be some wonderful thing that will appear upon the scene. And right now, we see very little evidence of it, and so it just is a matter of faith to understand whether or not it's going to happen. And that is where you and your relationship with God come in. In Daniel 7 and verse 25, it says, "He," and we have to identify who this he is, "he shall speak pompous words against the Most High," against God. "This will happen at the time of the end. He shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law," which that's kind of already been accomplished through history. They've changed the time of worship. They changed the day of worship, and they've been successful at that. What I would not be surprised at seeing is a calendar the likes of which Joe Dwornik has shown me in his house, which some still produce in Europe today, where it has Sunday as the seventh day of the week. And it's kind of a crazy calendar to look at, where the calendar ends up with Sunday, not the Sabbath. Even through all of the thousands of years since we've had a Julian calendar, at least there has been the preservation of the true Sabbath at the right-hand side of the calendar, right? But I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen, change. I don't know. That's speculation, but not mine. I mean, I'm just kind of wondering if that won't happen, because when you do things like that, you begin to influence people and change their minds. Oh, nobody's going to convince me that Saturday's not the seventh day. Well, hold on to your hats, folks, because we've been convinced of a lot more that we thought we might never be convinced to do in the last year. By the way, sometimes some very silly things, all in the name of keeping us healthy and keeping others healthy. Oh, you need to do this. And then there are other things that you need to do to keep others healthy. And if you were a good person, you would do that. Now, I've been against this and some of these things, and I'm not even going to mention them now. I've been against these from the beginning of the pandemic. And yeah, I've been criticized for my objection to them, but that's not the point. The point is, if people can be convinced in a worldwide way to do silly things that they think are making them good people, what else will they be convinced of when it really comes down to it? We haven't seen anything yet, in my opinion. In my opinion. So, the saint shall be given into his hand, which is perfectly consistent to what we see happening in Revelation 13 and verse 11. But I'm not going to go there yet. I'm first going to cite verse 8 to show you who this individual is. Verse 8, I was considering the horns, that is the previous horns in the earlier part of this chapter. In Daniel 7 and verse 8, I was considering the horns and there was another horn. Horn is symbol of government or governmental leader. So it talks about four governmental leaders, and then there's a little horn that comes up. It's kind of distinct. It's different from those main ones. Coming up among them, before whom the three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. That's where Justinian comes into play, because he was able to reunify Rome and get rid of these three groups that had displaced Rome and overcome Rome, the Vandals, Heruli, Ostrogoths. That was the break in history. That was the wound in history that Revelation 13 speaks about. And this little horn made it happen. The papacy at that particular time, which accepted Justinian as emperor and brought East and West together, brought Byzantine and Rome together, Constantinople and Rome together, unifying the empire and all this great glory. Oh, we're so happy again. So wonderful. And there in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, this is identical to the scenario you find in Revelation 13. This little horn, as inept as you look at some of these guys, some of these in the papacy, some of these who were popes, they were more army leaders than they were religious leaders. They had their own armies. They led troops into battle. Sometimes they battled against government forces. Yes, true. I don't expect that to happen in the future. Pope John Paul II was totally different than all of these. He was the most traveled pope in history. Most popes didn't travel very much at all. They stayed in the confines of the Vatican for hundreds of years. But Pope John Paul II, I mean, by all accounts, I mean, he's gone now, but he was a gentle man, kind, sincere man, meant well, certainly looks that way. But we know that the Bible shows that eventually there will be a united Europe. During the time of Reagan, Thatcher, Pope John Paul II, they really did some great things together from a human vantage point. And as long as they were in power, even though Pope John Paul II wanted to have a beautiful, peaceful, united Europe with Reagan and Thatcher in place, that wasn't going to happen because there was going to be a strong Anglo-American presence in the world that would, and has up until now, continued to dominate the world scene and prevent that from happening. But what these three brought to the stage in the 80s was something that is missing now, and that is leadership. Now, they had, for the most part, beneficent leadership, and that is what is missing in the equation of the European Union today, leadership. If you watch the summit meeting, the G7 summit meeting, you didn't really see any great leadership coming out of that meeting by anyone. We're not there yet. Revelation 13 and Daniel 7 both speak of a powerful religious leader who will appear on the scene at the time of the end. Turn to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11. Now, my purpose is not to frighten, or my purpose is to make aware. My purpose is to wake up. To wake up. I hope that we understand the severity of these things. We're not anticipating, oh, can't wait for that to happen. No, I don't. Not really. Revelation 11, this is the same horn that is spoken of in Daniel. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Now, you can't ascribe that nature to Pope John Paul II, the most influential pope in the history of the Roman Church. You cannot ascribe that type of attitude to him. And that type of person is not there today. My prediction, which is my speculation, is that a pope from South America is not going to be the final pope. Based on history, based on what has happened, I would think it'd be natural to see an Italian pope come to the scene and for the leader of the final revival of the Holy Roman Empire to be a German head. That's not much of a stretch, really. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and caused the earth and those who dwell in it to worship this European Union, to bow down to it, to lay homage to it, not just to pledge their allegiance to it, but to worship it because it has been the incarnation or the reincarnation of something that has been romanticized through history, and the reality of what is actually accomplished is all but forgotten. Now we're going to do it right. You see, that's when you get into liberalism, when you get to people that believe in socialism and communism, and the people that are the wild-eyed fanatics, they believe in an ideology that has been debunked and never worked. But it will work because now we have the right people in charge. It'll work because we're the ones doing it. And all through history, you know, if we could take this bad idea, which they don't think is bad, we take this false ideology, we can make it work because we're better than them. And that's what will happen. And it will work for a period of time because of might. And because of all of this bloodshed and tyranny, that's the only thing, that's the only way it all comes together. And it'll come together because he's going to perform great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven in the sight of all men. Oh boy, then we've got everybody's attention. How many people will be killed in that? We can only guess. It will be united in anarchy. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, I'm going to leave you with this. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, you've probably been giving a lot of thought to this particular passage. In verse 13, actually, 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 13, evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. We're not talking about the common criminal here. Did you get the right verse? I'm sorry. I don't know why I did that. Sorry, 2 Timothy. Let's all get on the same page here, which is 1609. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13. I'll let you get there. Okay. We were on the Bible study last week on Peter, 2 Peter, so I guess the Freudian thing happened there. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13. Evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. We're not talking about carny acts, you know, switching, you know, the pea, where's the pea in the shell, find it, you know. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about even thugs and criminals. We're talking about world leaders. Because we've always had crime throughout all of history. Paul isn't warning Timothy of just an escalation in things that we've always experienced. But imposters, people that occupy areas and impose their will. Now, if you haven't seen that happen in the last year, then you haven't been paying attention. Because there are, just in our country, we're not talking about the world here now, but if you were closely paying attention to what's happened during this pandemic, you would see very influential people in levels of government, in all of society, high tech, who have become imposters. They're trying to do things that they think are good for you. And yet, in many cases, they're imposters. They're not really good. They're not really good people. But even with all of their chicanery and their lies and their posturing, they haven't approached what this verse is speaking of and what will happen in the world. I could list many prominent people of authority who have used their leadership position to convince people to do things that a rational, normal mind would never accept, except under circumstances that are dramatic, which is what we were led to believe was happening beginning of March of last year, and that specific things must be done for the good of all. I don't even think we can imagine future crises and problems and difficulties that will be convinced, or mankind will be convinced, that they must or should do, which will be harmful in the end for all of mankind. Some of these leaders have done it for political expediency. Some have done it for gain. You take a look back in the last 4 years, and I think you're going to find a lot of examples of liars, cheats, people who are willing to do anything to obtain what they want in objection to what is appropriate and lawful, and I think that that is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of Bible prophecy. Many people have been willing to break the law in order to obtain their goal. And I'm talking about the law in this nation, which has been a nation of laws and rule and order, and a society which far exceeds all of this Pax Romana nonsense, which has never happened throughout history. We have witnessed evil men getting worse and worse. And again, I think it's only the tip of the iceberg. Most of the time, it's because they're not prosecuted. They're untouchable. They can't be prosecuted for their crimes, because in this nation, some of them have been in charge of the institutions that they are intended to represent for the good of mankind, but they haven't. And they've been very convincing. And they've gotten people to do things they wouldn't normally have done, but that's behind us now. This may give us a clue as to what will happen in the future with the man of sin, the man of lawlessness, whose powers will be far greater than just human means.